Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Jessen, the Honorable Kevin Ross presiding. Now calling case number A240618, State of Minnesota versus Andre Lorenzo D.
Good morning, counsel. And let me say I apologize for the late start. That is entirely on me. We have had a bit of a kerfuffle conundrum and a family emergency, which means that one of our members, Judge Cochran, will not be with us today during the oral argument, but she will have the opportunity to hear the oral argument entirely. And she has thoroughly read the briefs, and we are, although we'll miss her today, we will go ahead with the oral argument this morning that we've rescheduled for today. So welcome to the Court of Appeals for this October 28th panel. We will have one case on for our oral argument today, which we have called. Counsel, I'll just remind you of the rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your arguments with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each leg of the argument, even though we are seeing each other face to face, as it were, electronically. We're only keeping an audio recording for the public, so please do indicate your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you may.
I believe I'm unmuted. Can everyone hear me?
Yes, I think you are heard. And if any, and if either counsel, if you have any difficulty during the proceeding hearing either one of the judges' questions or each other, or seeing anyone, please let us know, and we'll just pause and let the figure out the technology at that time.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. Good morning. My name is Nicole Cornell. I'm an assistant Hennepin County attorney appearing on behalf of the state of Minnesota, the appellant in this matter. The district court here made factual and legal errors when it suppressed the drug evidence found on respondent's person in this case. Those errors warrant reversal and remand for a trial. I'll start by pointing out two considerations that are important for this case and that make this case sort of unique and support appellant's position that reversal is necessary in this case. And first, I'd like to touch on the evidence that was found on respondent's person in this case. Minnesota's plain jail case law typically regards small pieces of evidence, for example, a small rock of crack cocaine, you know, a small bubbled glass tube typical of smoking methamphetamine. But in this case, you know, evidence abounds. There was over 130 grams of fentanyl found on respondents, or that fell out of respondents' pants, that took the form of over 1,000 pills, small round white pills in clear plastic baggies. And then in addition to those drugs, there was $1,600, over $1,600 in cash, some cocaine, and lots of drug paraphernalia. And specifically, the evidence was found through respondent's light fabric athletic shorts in his waistband. So that makes the evidence found in this case different from other cases where police had to feel through jeans, through underwear, through multiple layers of clothing, thick layers of clothing. So I want to point out first that the evidence in this case makes it unique. And the second thing I want to point out that makes this case unique is what is not subject to this appeal. What is not challenged on this appeal is the district court's credibility findings of both officers in this case, but most notably Officer Smith, who is the officer who did perform the pat frisk with his right hand, which is captured on body-worn camera. First, with regard to the clearly erroneous factual finding in this case, when I read respondent's brief, I don't see any arguments that the district court did not make a clearly erroneous factual finding. And the factual finding that I'm noting here for your honors is specifically page 15 of the district court's memorandum, where the district court stated Officer Smith slid his fingers over the bag and held his hand on top of the bag for 8 seconds. And that's demonstrably untrue when you watch the body camera. I think what the district court could possibly have been referring to is the period of 4 seconds where Officer Smith sort of rested his hand on top. but didn't move it. And so appellant's first position is that is a clearly erroneous factual finding. Nothing happened for 8 seconds. There was no fondling of the sack of drugs for 8 seconds. If anything, we're talking about a period of 4 seconds with no manipulation.
I thought the video showed that at least his hand was moving on the object at some point.
Your Honor, I will say that when the pat frisk began, the whole period in question we're talking about is approximately a 10-second period. Certainly a normal pat frisk was occurring here. What Officer Smith's hand was doing is feeling the shorts. He first started feeling the right short pocket and then moved up to the right short waistband area. And you can see the second where his hand stops. And there might be like a smoothing motion, but there's nothing atypical of a normal frisk where the hand is sort of smoothing over an object and the officer is discerning what is there.
Well, but whether we're talking about movement that's 4 seconds or 10 seconds, you know, I read at a high level, the district court saying, well, if it takes that many seconds, it's not immediately apparent, right? Now, I know there's a lot more, but tell me what's, And that's what I'm struggling with, because we're reviewing this for an abuse of discretion.
Sure.
So help me with that, counsel. Why is my read of that wrong?
Well, there's several issues with that particular statement. And the first problem is you can't square that finding with the district court's credibility finding that Officer Smith testified it was immediately apparent to him that it was not just blanket contraband. It was the specific fentanyl pills that he had just found on the driver. So appellant's first argument is you can't square that credibility finding with this secondary sort of afterthought that the state has to explain away, you know, a period of 4 seconds where the hand is resting on top. So there's a couple problems there. And I'll just note that the credibility finding is important in this case, and the district court repeatedly stated that Officer Smith was credible. She stated it in the appellant's addendum on page 2, he's credible, and on pages 16 and 17, the district court sort of goes out of her way to say, you know, in the negative, Officer Smith is not credible, and then in the affirmative, he is definitely credible. And the credible testimony that we're talking about here is on transcript page 43. Officer Smith says, I immediately was able to discern that it's pills, most likely fentanyl pills, which I had found on the driver, and now respondent was going to be placed under arrest.
Couldn't we look at that and say, well, she found that he was credible and that he believed it was immediate, but that the district court implicitly didn't believe that it was immediately apparent under the case law, under the, whether it's 6 seconds, 8 seconds, 4 or 10. I mean, once again, I'm struggling with how we deal with this with our standard of review.
Sure. Well, that would be a legal error that the district court was requiring the state in this case to explain away the conduct in those 4 seconds. And let's be clear about the conduct of the 4 seconds. There's no movement of the hand, so no manipulation. Case law clearly says if you continue to manipulate, that's an additional search outside of Dickerson, so that's inappropriate. But here in those 4 seconds, zero movement of the hand. So manipulation is not on the table here. Now, with the 4 seconds and what else sort of the district court was examining the behavior of the 4 seconds, it could be time. And it seemed like the district court was concerned about not necessarily the time, but that the officer sort of was asking questions, which, you know, could lead someone to believe that, you know, his actual statement that I was immediately able to discern this was fentanyl pills was somehow not credible. Again, you can't square that with the credibility finding, but was the state required to explain away those 4 seconds where there was no additional search, no manipulation happening? And then he was essentially just asking questions. He stated, this is a sack, but Officer Smith stated, this is a sack, what's in the sack? And then he didn't move his hand for 4 seconds. So is the state required to explain away those 4 seconds? No. I don't see any reference in the case law where the state is required to, not just because the district court found him credible, but the officer's behavior there was not manipulating the object, which is prohibited. And the asking questions portion, An officer is allowed to ask questions during a stop, so long as there's a basis for that. And I want to be clear, Officer Smith knew what the sack contained. He wasn't saying, here's a sack, what's in the sack, as a question of, you know, genuine curiosity, what's in the sack. Instead, it, you know, at the very most, it would be sort of rhetorical. Officers can ask questions for a myriad of reasons. Maybe it's, you know, an opportunity for admission. Maybe it's, you know, putting, you know, on the record of the body-worn camera the thought processes that Officer Smith was having. Questions are a way for an officer to communicate with another officer. And frankly, to keep your hand on the sack and then ask the person that you're searching, what is it? I mean, that's a way to communicate with the person that you're asking the question to, even if it's a rhetorical question. So there's no way a reasonable person could look at this record and say, wow, that officer really didn't know what was in that sack. And he asked because he really didn't know what was in that sack. That's just an unreasonable read of the transcript. It's an unreasonable view of the body-worn camera. And on this record, there is no sort of basis for the district court to make a new rule requiring the state to explain away those 4 seconds. And I'll note that the Court of Appeals in State versus Krennic interpreted the phrase immediately apparent. And that doesn't mean a split second, and it also doesn't mean absolute certainty. What this court said in Krennic, and I'll quote just so I make sure I have it accurate here. In State versus Krennic, this court wrote, the phrase immediately apparent does not mean that an officer must be certain about the object's identity. Rather, an officer must have probable cause to believe that the item is contraband before seizing it.
So if I understand your basic argument here, tell me if I'm wrong, it's that, well, if it takes you 4 seconds to become, for something to be immediate apparent, that's sufficient under Terry.
Can you say that again, Your Honor?
Sure. If it takes 4 seconds of moving your hands to make sure an item become immediately apparent, that is sufficient to meet the playing field analysis.
It could be, and I'll just be clear. The 4 seconds that I keep referring to in the record is after it becomes immediately apparent, where there's a stop of hand movement. So there could be some period of time where it is reasonable that it does take that long for a brain to process. And I want to point out that in the field, if you're an officer, let's say Officer Smith was the only officer on scene at that time. There's a lot of input in the field, such that maybe an officer's thought processes are slightly slower. I think it would kind of depend on the totality of the circumstances here. But I don't disagree with Your Honor's point that there could be a moment when reasonableness kicks in. And, you know, if we need 30 minutes where you're just sort of frozen in time with a hand on the waistband, that could be unreasonable under Terry and Dickerson.
But under Terry, so when an officer knows at a high level, right, that the item's not a weapon, the search is over. And you're saying it's over plus, you know, 4 to 10 seconds.
You know, I'm not advocating for a new bright line rule here. What I will say, I'm sorry, Your Honor, were you saying?
No, I'm just trying to make sure I understand your point, counsel.
Sure. And this is important to bring up. In respondent's brief, they rely on Terry and several other cases, as did the district court, that if an officer feels something that is not contraband, the officer is supposed to immediately take his hands away and not finish the search, or he's not allowed to touch any further, and that's simply not the case. If an officer is performing a frisk, for a lawful frisk, which is what we have in this case, there was nothing wrong with that, and the officer finds something that is not a weapon, that does not mean everything stops and freezes in time. Instead, that means if that officer it becomes to that officer that what he is feeling is immediately apparent contraband at a probable cause standard, more likely than not, that what's in that pocket is contraband, then yes, he is entitled to not just hold his hand on the outside, which is a lesser intrusion, he's entitled under Dickerson to reach inside the pocket and retrieve the item. So that is essentially Another way that the district court here performed erroneous legal analysis. I'm not sure what standard she applied for immediately apparent, but the district court here decided that it wasn't a probable cause standard for immediately apparent, and that was clearly erroneous, or excuse me, that was a legal error in this case, which is reviewed de novo for this court. Does that answer your Honor's question? Okay.
Just to be clear, are you arguing that there is, to some extent, some allowance for some manipulation, either in terms of time or scope of handling, or are you saying that there was it's the district court clearly erred in finding any manipulation in this case?
The district court clearly erred for finding manipulation for a period of 8 seconds. That's
let's
just
for,
demonstrably
let's forget
untrue.
About the time. Let's assume, as Judge Jessen was assuming, that there's, for the purposes of my question, let's not think about time. Mm-hmm. What is your position with regard to whether an officer may continue to manipulate an object or maneuver his hands around or over the object to discern its identity after discerning it's not a weapon?
I am certainly, out of respect for your question, I want to answer it, but it depends on the facts and circumstances of the case. It depends on the type of object. It depends on the layers of clothing. It depends on the weather. It depends on the circumstances in the field. And
so there are circumstances, I gather from your answer, where an officer can continue to manipulate the object or maneuver his hands to discern the identity of the object, even after the officer discerns that it is, or fails to discern from plain touch, that it is immediately discerned that it's a weapon. You're saying there's some allowance that an officer can continue the manipulation.
I think there's two separate points in time that we're talking about. When it's immediately apparent, that is when probable cause attaches to reach inside, a greater intrusion. But in this case, we don't have, you know, it's immediately apparent, let me continue to smooth over. We don't have that. And I guess I'm struggling to answer Your Honor's question because Your Honor is using the word manipulation. Manipulation and squeezing, rolling, poking, I guess those are buzz phrases from case law that is inappropriate. That additional movement of the hands means that's an additional search outside the bounds of Dickerson.
And that doesn't matter whether it's 15 seconds or 3 seconds.
Oh, I agree with Your Honor that the cornerstone of Fourth Amendment here is reasonableness. There is a time.
Not my question. My question isn't whether it's reasonable. My question is, it doesn't matter whether it's 3 seconds or 15 seconds, any additional manipulation or squeezing or poking to discern the identity of the object you recognize is outside the scope of the officer's authority. If the officer has not determined, once the officer through original manipulation does not believe that it's a weapon, that ends the officer's opportunity to manipulate, touch, squeeze, or whatever the object, for whatever period of time.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. It depends on if it's immediately apparent. At the same time, it's not a weapon, but it is contraband. That usually goes hand in hand, as it was in this case. And I realize my time is up, but I'm happy
you'll,
to
you'll
continue
have 5 minutes,
Your Honor.
You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal time as
okay,
well.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. First, I want to thank the court and counsel for rescheduling this hearing. I was ill when we were due to appear in person, but I appreciate rescheduling. May it please the court and counsel, the district court correctly found that knowing that whatever was in Mr. D's right pocket waistband area was not a weapon, to quote, the scope of the Terry frisk was unlawful, because when Officer Smith located the sack of suspected contraband, he ran his fingers across and held onto it in a manner that exceeded the bounds of plain feel. Applying the proper standard of review and well-established Fourth Amendment law concerning the permissible scope of warrantless searches under Terry, as well as the state's burden here of proving that an exception to the warrant requirement applies, compels the result that the district court should be affirmed. The state fails to do this, and its arguments for reversal should be rejected. I want to start my analysis with the standard of review, which Judge Jessen quite correctly noted a few times. The judge's factual findings, Judge Huddleston's factual findings, are subject to the clearly erroneous standard. Under that standard, the Minnesota Supreme Court has made clear that the district court's factual findings will not be disturbed unless they are manifestly contrary to the weight of the evidence or not reasonably supported by the evidence as a whole. This court, of course, is a court of review. It does not reweigh evidence. It does not engage in fact-finding or reconcile conflicting evidence. When the record reasonably supports the findings at issue, it is immaterial that the record might also support a different conclusion.
Does the record support the district court's 15-second time assessment?
I believe it does, Your Honor. But as the court, both I think you, Judge Ross, and Judge Jessen have noted, whether it's 4 seconds, 8 seconds, 15 seconds is immaterial. I think when you look at that body-worn camera of Officer Smith, the conclusion is absolutely clear that manipulation goes on. The hand going back and forth and up and down and squeezing in and out and the fingers going in and out. And I think it makes sense. But ultimately, the state wants you to ignore the factual findings. The issue here is not ultimately whether I think the state's view or my view is correct or not, or is more plausible or not. The issue here is whether the district court's factual findings on that point were clearly erroneous.
But Mr. Kent, aren't you asking us to ignore the factual finding that Officer Smith's testimony was credible, which is... That's my concern, is how are we to review this when that credibility assessment is at odds, I think, with the finding that the item was immediately apparent?
I'm not asking you to ignore
that. Was not immediately apparent.
Yeah, I'm not asking you to ignore it at all, Judge Jessen. In fact, the question I think you posed earlier is appropriate here. How do you square those two? And I think the way you square them is exactly what Judge Huddleston found. The testimony is inconsistent with the body-worn camera footage. There is a discrepancy between those two, and that discrepancy was never resolved by the state. Now, the state here puts forth, frankly, conjecture that, well, you know, the officer's statements about what's in the sack or what do you have here are rhetorical. There's absolutely nothing in the record to support that, nothing at all. But I would point that district court, or the court specifically, a district court's findings that the body-worn camera footage shows Officer Smith sliding his fingers over the bag and then holding his hand on top of the bag for another 8 seconds as he asked Mr. D, "You got a sack down here. What's in the sack?" The district court also found that Officer Smith knew the sack was not a weapon, but he ran his fingers back and forth and over the sack and asked Mr. D what it was. The district court also found that the state had not shown the reason for Officer Smith's decision to question Mr. D and hold on to the axe. So the sack. So it's the discrepancy, Your Honor. That's how you square the two. Because while she found the officer was credible, there was an unexplained discrepancy, a contradiction, if you will, between his testimony and the video evidence. As the district court observed, if I can, because I think this goes directly to your question, Judge Jessen, why, if Officer Smith recognized the fentanyl pills right away, did he move his fingers up and down and left his hand on the sack while he asked Mr. D about the contents? So that is how you square the two. You have to look at the evidence as a whole. The state wants to just peel away the testimony and ignore the body-worn camera footage. And that, of course, is not the approach this court should take. As a court of review, you have to view all the evidence and conclude from all the evidence, was the district court's finding reasonable? Was it manifestly contrary to the evidence? And I think it's pretty clear it was reasonable.
Would you agree with me, Mr. Getz, that, while I hear you saying in part we need to look at the body camera, what shows his hand moving versus his testimony, but that we should not be take into that calculus the fact that he asked this question, because I saw that a lot in your brief and some of what the district court says, because it does make sense to me, as I think Ms. Cornell argued, that look, under State versus, I think it is Krenek, it's just got to be probable cause. It does, you don't have to be certain. So you could have probable cause to believe something was, that the item, the identity of the item, but still not be certain. And so appropriately ask the question.
Yes, but the probable cause finding must be immediate. So I think the state was correct to tie the immediacy, if you will, of recognizing that something is not a weapon, but at the same time recognizing, oh, we have contraband here, such as that crack pipe in Krennic. The probable cause finding, well, I don't know exactly what it is, but it feels like a crack pipe to me, was immediate at the same time it was determined not a weapon. That's not what happened here at all. And we see that on the body-worn camera. And the statements the officer makes, what do you have here? What's in the sack? Are indicative of his state of mind. Why, as a district court noted, if he knew what he was dealing with a bag of fentanyl pills, hey, you got dope here, don't you? These are pills. You got the same stuff that your buddy had, but there's nothing like that. Instead, he questions, he asks, what's in the sack? And I think that is powerful evidence that's indicative that he did not know. It was not immediately apparent. So the bright line rule then, under clear Fourth Amendment of law, is having determined that it was not a weapon. That's it. The search is over. Warrantless searches, of course, are per se unreasonable unless the state proves that a well-delineated exception to the warrant requirement applies. A warrantless search must be sufficiently limited in scope and duration. And to exceed that scope and duration after the officer knew he was not dealing with a weapon was constitutionally impermissible. And that's exactly what happened here.
Well,
Now,
how
the
much,
state, I'm sorry.
so you agree that the officer didn't have to be certain of the identity of the pills. He touches it, knows it's a pill. And so let's talk about this period between the question and the answer. How certain must the officer have been about, or how high must his suspicion have been that the pill in the car and the pill in the pocket were one and the same before probable cause is reached?
Respectfully, Judge Ross, I guess I would disagree with the predicate fact in there. He doesn't know that it was a pill without manipulation. And I think you can see that. And I think as a practical matter, you're dealing about there were, first of all, there was two items, two bags. There was a larger bag that fell, but that's not what he was feeling in the right pocket. It was a much smaller. So you're dealing something within clothing, within plastic, and small items. He doesn't know there's pills there until he manipulates the items, and you can see that clearly on the video.
And then there's the question.
I quite frankly, I think yes, but
Well, is
well,
it?
but I
Well,
think the we don't know from the record
for
whether.
my hypothetical, let's just assume hypothetically that the officer, whatever the officer did, whether it was manipulation, let's assume it was the officer was aware that it was a pill without manipulation, just for the sake of the question. And then the officer, knowing that it's a pill, how much confidence did the officer have to have in linking the pill to the illegal nature of the pill? I'm trying to get at the issue of, you don't have to know the actual identity, but probable cause doesn't require that much. How much does it require? How much the how high was the How much suspicion did he have to have before it was sufficient for probable cause?
He had to have probable cause, Your Honor, and as the court is well aware, that's not a high standard. He
But
just had to.
did he have to have the answer to the question by the
What
defendant?
kind of pill is this?
Yes.
I don't think he did, quite frankly, because I think given all the facts, his determination that it was contraband would have been reasonable just by feeling that there's pills in there. But I don't think the record supports, and the district court certainly didn't find that he immediately concluded there were pills in the sack without manipulation. Had the district court made that finding, we wouldn't be here. But we are because the district court never found that. To the contrary,
just so I'm clear, you're conceding that even without the question, if the officer had felt the object and it was immediately apparent to the officer that it was a pill, that would be sufficient for probable cause and under the facts of this case?
Well, respectfully, those are not the facts of this case.
I understand. That's why I posed it as a hypothetical.
In a hypothetical different case, yes, but that's not our case. Because I think the fact that the officer asked the question, what do you have in the sack, cannot be limited, respectfully, Judge Ross, in the manner that you're doing, saying, what kind of pills are these? If that's what his question was, he would have asked that. But he didn't ask that. He's saying, what's in the sack? That would suggest he didn't know the contents as a whole. He didn't know whether he was dealing with pills, whether he was dealing with some other kind of hard object. All he knew that it wasn't a weapon, but he kept manipulating the area as the body-worn camera clearly shows. Whether it's 1 second, 2 seconds, 3 seconds, 8 seconds, doesn't matter.
Like what? I'm just curious, if you don't think the officer believed it was a pill, but knew it was a small object inside of a sack, speculate with me. What other kind of object might the officer have supposed it to be?
It could have been anything.
Like,
but it well, I think you can have, it could have been agate collection. Perhaps he was up on the North Shore, you know, searching for agates. I'm just, the question poses many hypotheticals, Your Honor. It could have been anything. We don't know, but that's not the standard, of course. The contraband nature has to be immediately apparent. That's probable cause, but that probable cause must be immediately apparent. So I think one could speculate it was other things, but the fact is the record shows he didn't know. And that's clearly what the district court found. And I think this court, you know, has previously, I understand it's persuasive authority, but State versus Pendleton is exactly this case. It's exactly this case. There you had an officer feeling something in the crotch area. It was a rock-like object. So your question, Judge Ross, is equally applicable here. What else could it be but crack cocaine? But he doesn't know. He doesn't know what it is. But he keeps feeling that object at the same time.
Counsel, I feel that Judge Jessen has a question.
I do. If you don't mind, I just want to, before your time is up, ask about something you both dealt with in your footnote, and that is about the act of resisting arrest and fleeing on foot and whether that could purge any taint in the frisk. I mean, your point, I think, in your footnote, well, they didn't raise that below, it's waived, you know, but as you know, our case law says waived unless that's generally, unless justice requires that we consider it and address it. And we do have, you know, case law that says in, you know, similar situations, it could, you know, that could suffice. So could you help me with that? Why shouldn't we, in the sense of justice, look at that?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, it hasn't been thoroughly briefed by either parties. It was mentioned in a footnote by the state. I responded accordingly in a footnote. So if we are going to raise this issue, then I think both parties deserve a chance to thoroughly brief it. But as I think, it was not even considered or raised below. I think any flight here is, of course, after the search, and that's, you know, it was the unlawful search, and I think that that disposes of that issue.
Thank you.
So I hope I've answered the court's questions, and I appreciate the interesting hypotheticals, but I have nothing further. Thank you.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to first begin by dispelling the argument that there is a discrepancy between Officer Smith's testimony and the body-worn camera, and there is not in this case. And similarly, I'd like to go back to the conversation we were having earlier, Judge Ross, about, you know, how much time does an officer get to determine something's immediately apparently contraband? And my answer still stands. The answer is it depends. And the answer in this case is it clearly was instantaneous, and not just because You know, this is a 13-year veteran on the Bloomington Police Department who has performed a bunch of frisks before. He's felt baggies of pills, no doubt, although that's not in the record. But what is in the record is Officer Smith did feel the same baggie of pills in the driver's sock. And so I do think that is an important fact when we're determining, you know, was it instantaneous in this case? Yes, it was instantaneously not a weapon and it was contraband. But to your Honor's point, how much time does an officer get to feel before determining immediately it's contraband? And I still think it depends. And the one circumstance I'll add here is this is a bigger bag of pills. It's not the 1,000 baggie of pills that fell out of respondent's pants, but it is a bag of almost 200 pills. And to smooth your hand over it, yes, the pills might move around because that's the nature of that object. And the nature of the object here is a baggie, thin plastic baggie of pills moving around. And so just by moving your hand over the object, it is going to move around some pills, but that doesn't mean there's improper movement here. It doesn't mean there's poking, squeezing, prodding, rolling, as there is in quite a bit of the crack cocaine cases. So
Why wouldn't the officer suppose that maybe it's North Shore rocks?
I wouldn't have used agate as an example. I would have maybe said button or something. But I mean, there's just no, that would go against reason and common sense. Whether you're doing a clearly erroneous factual finding review or a de novo review, that defies reason and common sense in this case based on these facts, based on what Officer Smith just felt minutes prior when he was patting down the driver in this case. Sorry, I thought we were going to have a back and forth there, Judge. I'll continue.
No, that was Mr. Okay, Getz so, will be thinking about other examples he might have
sure,
given
sure.
other than agates.
The other part I wanted to touch on is the questions. You know, opposing counsel is saying, obviously, by saying, here is a sack, what's in the sack means Officer Smith had no clue that it was pills or that it was contraband in that baggie. And just for the purposes of reviewing the whole record here, I want to highlight respondent's answer to that question is, what, are you talking about me? I mean, does that question really mean he was genuinely curious if Officer Smith was talking to him and about him?
The difficulty you have, I think, you know, if the case would have come out the other way and the district court would have treated the question as the sort of rhetorical question that you're suggesting, I think you'd be on stronger ground. But we're stuck with the district court's, we're stuck with reconciling the factual determination of the district court in a manner that's consistent with the district court's legal conclusions.
Mm-hmm. And what I will reiterate is, again, we're talking about that 4 seconds, so when the hand stops moving, and my argument is that was instantaneously, immediately, apparently specific contraband that was found just moments prior. But again, the district court's sort of legal analysis here is like in Pendleton, wanting to know why post immediately apparent conduct took place, and conduct meaning questions and then resting the hand on top. There is no legal precedent requiring the district court to require under, you know, the preponderance of the evidence, you know, satisfy an exception to the warrant requirement that the state is required to do. There's no requirement that the district court has to make the state prove that post immediately apparent conduct. And the only support for that is Pendleton. And Pendleton is non-precedential and highly distinguishable there. There, the frisk wasn't lawful to begin with. There was no credibility finding. And in fact, I did pull the briefs on Pendleton. And the facts in Pendleton are the officer supposedly felt through jeans, through underwear, through a sewn special pouch inside the underwear, a very small piece of cocaine, I believe it was. And the facts in this case could not be further from the truth. That particular sort of analogy is legally erroneous and certainly not bearing on the facts of this case. I realize my time is up, but appellant is asking this court to reverse and remand for trial.
Thank you. It doesn't appear as if there are any other questions from Judge Jessen, and I have no further questions. I appreciate you accommodating our delay in getting to you this morning, with apologies for starting later than we had planned this morning, but we appreciate your briefing and your oral argument. And like I said, Judge Cochran will have the opportunity to participate with us before we make any decisions in this case. and the opportunity to review the entire oral argument today, as well as, of course, she's had the opportunity to review the briefs and the record. So thank you both. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period, and have a great day.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.